SNI Digital, Innovations in Learning, in association with the UCLA Department of Neurosurgery. Lindy Liao, its chairwoman, and its faculty are pleased to bring to you the UCLA Department of Neurosurgery 101 Lecture Series on Neurosurgery and Clinical and Basic Neuroscience. This series of lectures are provided free to bring the advances in clinical and basic neuroscience to physicians and patients everywhere. One out of every five people in the world suffer from a neurologically related disease. This lecture and discussion is in the area of spine and spinal cord diseases. Its topic is tethered cord syndrome. And as the speaker will say, it probably is more properly called the tight phylum syndrome or the cord traction syndrome. The speaker is Ulrich Batzdorf, professor of spinal neurosurgery in the Department of Neurosurgery at the David Geffen School of Medicine at the UCLA Medical Center.
Well, good morning, everybody. Sorry about the confusion about time, and thank you for the opportunity to share some thoughts about adult tethered cord syndrome. Anthony Wong spoke about the pediatric variety some time ago. And just for the record, the nomenclature tethered cord was introduced by a very well-known pediatric neurosurgeon, Harold Hoffman, at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto almost 50 years ago. And as you'll see, it's descriptive in that sense, but probably we could do a little bit better with some alternative nomenclature. And I'm going to make some introductory comments, long ones, a little bit repetitious, and then share with you our experience here at UCLA with 30 patients that Dr. Holly, Dr. Liu, and I have had over the years. So just by way of record, the terminology of tethered cord, the cord can be tethered anywhere along its course. We're going to be speaking about tethering in the lumbar region, but actually we've seen tethering of the cord from inflammation, infection, subarachnoid hemorrhage, which can scar anywhere along. I've had one patient many, many years ago who had a tethered cord from a shunt of a syrinx cavity, and this can be problematic. So just by way of review of the anatomy, I don't have a pointer here, but the phylum can be the phylum internal, external phylum is of course not the one that we address. We go intradurally it appears, as you'll see in a moment, that the dura coalesces at the very apex, lower apex, and then forms or blends into the external phylum at that point. And there are nerve roots that are present all the way down to the tip of the conus. We can define tethered cord as acquired from surgery, trauma, infection, and inflammation. And the developmental ones are mostly lumbar and occur in children and adults. And there are, in the surgeon's experience, those that are primary and have had no prior surgery, and they're defined as having a low conus position, as you'll see. But there's also, in recent years, the concept of an occult tethered cord where the conus is in normal position and the phylum is still tight. We'll address that. And the treatment of that is somewhat controversial even to this day. And just as a matter of interest, the NIH is conducting a randomized trial right now, or is going to launch it very soon, to address the question whether occult tethered cord should be treated surgically or non-surgically. And then we all have seen so-called secondary tethered cord in adults, people who've had surgery in early childhood or infancy, and then have later problems. The study by O'Connor is useful because it combines data from 730 patients. And as you can see, the average year of presentation is in mid-30s. And the concept of duration of symptoms prior to treatment is of interest because there are some people who would say anywhere from 3 to 5 years is the most that you can do before expecting a permanent deficit in all regions. And the manifestations, external manifestations, you can see for yourself, many people have cutaneous or subcutaneous stigmata, deformities of the feet, scoliosis, and a history of spina bifida. And just to illustrate these, I borrowed some illustrations from Netter. And this is just to illustrate the kind of foot deformity one can see and the kind of dermal sinus one may see. Clinically, there are several different manifestations. Weakness of the lower extremities with or without atrophy, pain, which can be in the low back and one or both legs, problems with sphincter control, both urinary and rectal, which can vary from urgency to incontinence, sensory symptoms, and as you can imagine, depending on the location of the conus, you may have spasticity. And in another paper, the presentation in this group, 42% of patients had some kind of cutaneous or subcutaneous manifestations. Scoliosis, surprisingly, is quite common, and foot deformities. signs and symptoms, pain. Pain is a major mode of presentation. And we've also seen motor deficits, as you'll see, sensory deficits, and bladder dysfunction, very often overlooked, but sometimes, let's say, overreacted. Bowel dysfunction, and only a few people have no problems. The pain is rarely in radicular distribution. It's often bilateral. And interestingly, and obviously for reasons, because the phylum is tight, may be precipitated by forward bending or stretching. And it may also be in the perineal and anal region. Neurologic manifestations are an important part of it. And the symptoms can vary from retention to incontinence to frequency and frequent UTIs. And on electrical testing, one can have both detrusor under or overactivity as well as sphincter dysfunction. And Dr. Nathan Selden in Oregon made this statement that there may be a subgroup of patients with voiding issues who have normal imaging but abnormal urodynamics and who can benefit from tethered cord surgery. And in those patients, he demonstrated histological abnormalities in the phylum. The phylum is composed of ependema, connective tissue, pial surface, and surface veins. And we've all seen the surface veins as a hallmark of the tethered cord. And this is from Dr. Sullivan's paper. And in the upper row, you see a histology of a normal phylum. And in the lower one, you can see the increased collagen content and scarring of a tight phylum. And interestingly, there are different types of pathology. In fact, phylum terminology in an adult is really, it's a mixed bag, and there's no one pathological entity. The most common pathology is some kind of fatty infiltration, fatty tumor, fatty phylum, and this may be in terms of some studies, impaired secondary neurulation. Tumors, again, lipomas are prominent, scar adhesions from adhesive arachnoiditis. Collagen fibrosis is postulated, and you'll see an example in a moment, in patients with Ehlers-Danlos, where it is thought that the overstretching of the phylum in these hypermobile people generates some changes in the collagen of the phylum and makes it tight without necessarily being low in position. And that's where this concept of occult phylum comes into consideration. Lymphocytic infiltration has been cited. And then, of course, there's structural adhesions, septa, which may be bony septa, dural septa, and myelomeningocele. And this is an example, again, the normal and what I was telling you about in Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, where collagen changes have been noted. And Dr. Petra Klinge at Brown is a strong advocate of untethering people with Ehlers-Danlos in this situation. And this is just to illustrate that over the years, people have tested the strength of the phylum and invariably come up with the conclusion that in adult tethered cord, the phylum is tight. And I think from that point of view, thinking of it not as tethering, but rather as a tight phylum helps me think of it in more physiological terms rather than purely anatomical terms. In O'Connor's study, as I mentioned before, some kind of fatty degeneration or fatty tumors, very, very common. And fibrous adhesions, split cord malformations are relatively uncommon in our experience. And some people have had a prior myelomeningocele repair. This is also reflected in Benny Iskandar's study from 1988. Again, lipoma, fatty phylum, very, very common as a part of the pathology. So the common denominator of all the pathological conditions is increased tension on the conus and nerve roots. And for that reason, as I say, it might be more appropriate to call it a tight phylum syndrome because it reflects the pathology. Several comorbidities have been identified. We've talked about spinal dysraphism and connective tissue disorders such as Ehlers-Danlos. There's some controversy about a comorbidity with Chiari anomalies. And I have to be candid. I think there were There was a group in Spain that recommended phylum section as an initial treatment for Chiari, and they claimed great success, but they had, I think, 20 patients in their report. And Dr. Millerat said something like 14% of his patients had, of his Chiari patients benefited because they had a tethered cord. But his criteria, as reflected in what he wrote, really used different criteria for identifying what a tethered cord is, and it was based largely on clinical evidence rather than pathological evidence. So the current thinking is that a tethered cord section, phylum section in Chiari patients is, quote, experimental. The function of the phylum to reduce traction on the conus and corticobiliary nerve roots with normal flexion and extension. And the dentates also play a role in this protection of the cord. And for that reason, repetitive stretching maneuvers often are the precipitating factors of clinical presentation, direct trauma, growth, and then of the developmental comorbidities. We've all seen some patients who've had disc disease, obesity, because of the possibility that the fat in the phylum or in the lipoma may increase with obesity, plays a role in advising patients to lose weight, or doing other maneuvers for weight reduction may play a significant role. Dr. Shoki Yamada, who is lived in Southern California, was at Loma Linda, and was he was very interested in tethered cord problems and made it a lifetime study. And he did some experimental work in cats as well as in men. And what basically he established is that there's a change in the oxidative metabolism of the cord and of the phylum when it's stretched and tight, which is relieved when the phylum is transected, and the redox potentials return to more normal after the cord has been untethered. This is what you use. And this is just to show a couple of his slides. You see the return to more normal values. This was in man, this was also in man. And the imaging findings are self-evident. Low conus is in most, but not all patients, minor bifida. You can see them for yourself. And this is just a few examples to illustrate the point. This is from Dr. Kleekamp's atlas. Dr. Kleekamp, by the way, some of you may remember him. He spent a year with us here at UCLA many years ago and is practices in Germany. So here you can see a thickened phylum as indicated by the arrows, fatty phylum, particularly in this view, you can see the fat signal, and down in the axial image as well. It's split cord with a dural septum, and then he has one with a bony septum. These are all examples of tethering in adults. Terminal syrinx is also seen in some frequency. So there's controversy about the treatment. Observation with repeat evaluation, as I said before, and you'll see in a moment, people, Arnold Menezes and others have said best results within 3 years or within 5 years of clinical diagnosis. And certainly in very obese patients, it is worth a try to have the patient lose weight drastically to see whether that offers any improvement. But if you think about the physiology, the phylum is tight, you have to have substantial reduction in the amount of fat in the lipoma or in the cord termination to effect an improvement. So as far as surgery is concerned, in adults, we can do laminectomy and phylum section or excision of a portion of the phylum. Subtraction osteotomy has been recommended for some patients who have had repeat tethering of the cord, and we'll touch on that very briefly. And of course, resection of a septum, midline septum, is another way of treating these, which I didn't include in that list. And very important to do electrical monitoring, as we do here too on its patients. And you can see the changes. Now, this is from the literature. Relief of pain in approximately 80%. Neurological deficits improve in about 60% of patients, and bowel and bladder symptoms in about half the patients. But there is a significant incidence of recurrent tethering of the cord in adults. People have recommended various steps to reduce the likelihood of recurrence, frequent turning postoperatively. I actually like to keep patients prone or semi-prone for a couple of weeks after this kind of surgery, using a synthetic material for duroplasty. And what I mean by traction sutures and the duroplasty is to tent the graft up alongside the walls of the cavity, the surgical cavity, so that the graft is less likely to fall back down onto the area that you've just done the phylum section. And as some of you already know, blood in the subarachnoid space is greatest enemy. It leads to scarring and further adhesions. So this is our experience finally at UCLA, 30 patients between Dr. Holley's, Dr. Liu's, and my cases. And as you can see, we too had the largest number were people who had some fat component to the phylum, spina bifida, terminal syrinx, and tumor in two patients. And most of our patients were primary cases, but we did have some who had a history of spina bifida or had a previous resection of a lipoma or scar tissue. And the majority had a low-lying conus at L3-4 or L4, and some even lower than that. But occasionally you find some up higher, with particularly with tumors or with fatty infiltration. In our series, the majority of patients presented first with bowel or bladder problems. A good number of them had weakness and pain, which was either in the low back or in the lumbar region, or occasionally headache in one patient. Sensory impairment was seen in small number. And on examining these patients, sensory deficit was the most common finding, weakness or atrophy. Reflex, absence of reflexes, I think, is very important and often overlooked sign. And sometimes you've had patients who had a dermal sinus excised in infancy, or who have a little hairy patch, as we know. And this is what we did, debulking of a lipoma, resecting tumors, assess phylum resected in 11 and phylum cut in 2. And there's some controversy as to whether there's a benefit to resecting a portion of the phylum. In my own mind, I always think that if you take a segment of the phylum out, not only is it useful for histology and interest, but it also, and I may be wrong in this, reduces the likelihood of retethering because you have less of an element that can flop around and attach itself somewhere.
I can understand all the other lipomas, the post-myelomeningocele retethering, but how can a phylum section retether if it pops, you know, when you do this, you'd like to see it, you know, ascend and all that. How can it retether if it's not even in the same neighborhood? It doesn't make sense.
Well, retethering doesn't mean that it retethers in the same exact same area. And it just means that whatever is left at the tip of the cord can attach itself. And I think that if there's a lot of blood that isn't cleaned up before dural closure, you can see how that little tail can attach itself to the blood clot, and the blood clot organizes and form scar tissue. That's my way of conceptualizing that. I haven't seen any evidence for this because, I mean, among other things, the initial operation, the reoperation, mostly aren't done at the same place, same facility. And but it's a good question. And but I think it's also true that the cord doesn't retract to the same degree in every patient in whom you cut the phylum. But I, as I say, in my naive way of thinking about this, if you leave less of a tail, it's less likely to reattach itself. And that question has not been studied, as far as I know. This was just to focus on the question of retraction. It was seen in a number of patients, but not in everybody. And these were our postoperative results. And you can see that all three major manifestations, pain, bowel and bladder problems, and low extremity weakness, all tended to improve, although some patients don't change and a very small number get worse. And I don't have an explanation as to why some people get worse, other than if the phylum is surrounded by functioning nerve roots and they're either retracted or damaged in the course of the dissection, you can see how patients might be worse. This corresponds also with the experience of other people like Arnold Menezes. Again, pain improves in majority, motor and sensory deficits, bowel and bladder function tend to improve in the majority of patients. And in Benny Iskandar's experience as well. So we are right in there with other major reports. And these were the trends which I thought were of interest, that the best results were seen in patients who had a fatty phylum or had a tumor. Oh, best overall results in terms of pain, bowel and bladder problems, and weakness. I mentioned briefly subtraction osteotomy. I don't know whether any of you have ever seen it, but I'm told that it is a formidable procedure. But in desperate situations where particularly people who've had one or more explorations of the phylum, it is something to consider. And this was the subject of an article in Journal of Neurosurgery by Shi. And there's a man, Dr. Nicholas at Cornell, who has also done this, and I've seen videos of his doing it, and it is indeed a formidable procedure. So some questions remain. How complete should defatting of the lipoma be? Dr. Hector James, who many years ago was at UCSD, cautioned against being overly aggressive because the lipoma may have nerve roots attached or may even be infiltrated by nerve roots. And some of the poorer outcomes, he thought, were related to being overly aggressive in trying to resect the lipoma. And we've already touched on the question whether resecting a part of the phylum has a prognostic value, a question which has not been studied. And should one insert a dura graft? Well, sometimes the situation lends itself best to primary closure, but if you do put in a graft, tent it up and away from the area of your decompression. And I think that's, we've talked about this, and as I said to you before, the treatment for occult tethered cord is currently a subject of discussion, but Dr. Klinger advocates sectioning it. So just to summarize, very common cutaneous manifestations, and pain is most common, fatty tissue and infiltration is most common, decreased elasticity or tightness of the phylum is common to all types, and pain responds better than other symptoms, and the earlier the better to treat, best when treated under 5 years of symptoms. Thank you.
Hey, Rick, I got a question for you. So first of all, thank you for giving that great talk. And for everybody here, whenever Dr. Basdorf is giving a lecture or a talk, make sure you listen, because there's so much knowledge, there's so much information that he's accrued over so many years, and there's never going to be anybody like him ever again. And he is a treasure for all of us, and we should all, every breath, everything he does, watch and listen to him, pay attention to.
Thank you. I hope there'll never be another person like that either.
So I do have a question for you, Rick. In terms of, you know, one of the things about these procedures that can be a little disappointing is the post-operative imaging. You know, we're used to seeing imaging, you know, tumors, the tumor's gone, or Chiari, syrinx is gone or better. At times, the post-operative imaging for tethered cord is not as spectacular. And as Marvin described, and as you described, commonly when you section the phylum, you see it zip up out of your field, you know, which is one of the technical nuances to make sure you coagulate it well and cut it a little bit at a time, because once you cut it, it goes, and you will not find it. And if it's still bleeding up above, you're in a world of hurt now. You got to do another, you know, laminectomy and everything. But despite seeing that action on your post-operative MRIs, it doesn't show as much of an ascent as you would have thought commonly. And so any thoughts about that in general and how to, because then the radiologist says, well, it's not significantly different. The patient says, you know, not significantly different. How do you kind of reconcile those things? And particularly with their exam being better as we've seen.
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. And I think one of the things that, again, I have not seen any valuable discussion in the literature. If you think of a 10-year-old having the phylum transected, this individual has had 10 years of a lower chord. But if you think of somebody 35 years old, I think some changes, including alterations in the dentate ligament from years of the low position, are permanent. I think that the dentate ligaments, for example, become less elastic and have been stretched for 30 years. It's unreasonable to expect that they're going to say, oh, thank you, and we can now get back to our normal position. So I think that the age of the individual, as well as the severity of displacement, may play a role in that. I don't know the exact answer.
Another way to think about it, if you did this operation in the patient in the supine position like they are in an MRI scan, it may not go up the same way it goes up in surgery, but it's a very abnormal position. So if you were able to scan a patient on the Wilson frame or whatever right you used,
you may see
in the OR. So it just could be a position issue.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, you know, schwannomas, kind of moderate size schwannomas can move from where you level, you see them on the MRI, you get in the OR, it could be up a fair amount or down a little bit. So I think that's probably a good part of the point, Marvin, that there's a little more mobility there than you think.
If you're sectioning the phylum, is there like the best level or location to do so? I imagine, you know, too high up near the conus is bad, or where is like your preferred?
That's good. Interesting question. Where is the best level to section the phylum? I like to have in my exposure a clear segment of phylum. I mean, there's very often, as you know, a prominent blood vessel on the surface of the phylum. I don't want to get too close to the conus, but I don't know that there's any benefit in terms of likelihood of retethering to section it higher or lower. Interesting question. Anyway, Aria?
Professor, great talk. I have a question for you for that controversial, those controversial patients where you see symptoms of tethered cord, but with a normal position of the conus. What do you think the role of actually finding a fatty phylum is? So if you don't, so presence versus absence of having fat in the phylum, does that?
Having a fatty phylum
in that
area? I think that's entirely possible. Yeah, I think it's, and I would, you know, doing the exposure and sectioning it is a relatively straightforward procedure with minimal postoperative consequences if done properly, and I would give the patient the benefit of the doubt in that instance.
Have you seen that? Have we treated that condition, or do you call?
I don't recall that any of the cases that I reviewed fall into that category. I mean, we all know and will not mention that this has been done to excess by some people in pediatric populations and has led to unnecessary procedures.
I think for the residents, you should understand it when you look at the literature and the history of this, that it's interesting that you mentioned Chiari, because the same goes for Chiari zero, where there was this one center who was cleaning up.
Yeah.
And you know, one of the criteria for diagnosis was, you know, cash pay or good insurance, because it only existed in people who could pay. Isn't that true?
It's totally true.
Absolutely true. Yeah. And so it's one of those diagnoses that the symptoms are nonspecific and can be caused by a lot of things and can lead to this, I'm going to go in there and do this. So like even at Brown, look at Dr. Bastorf's and Dr. Hawley's new series here. There's 30 cases over 24 years. That's because we have a very well-selected group of patients who've been, you know, exquisitely studied, and you have really good outcomes versus if you open it up and all of a sudden say, well, I'm going to start doing this because any child with enuresis, I'm going to do a tethered cord. You could make a lot of money, but you can, you know, and at Brown, I think this diagnosis is the most profitable diagnosis at Brown. And you wonder if there's other secondary forces here leading to this excessive, I mean, because they do probably 30 cases every 6 months or something.
But there's one thing that I did not mention, which I've certainly advocated, as some of you know. I think imaging the patient in the supine and prone position is helpful from a diagnostic point of view, because if the cord is truly tethered, as in the case that you mentioned of fatty infiltration of the phylum, if the cord remains dorsal when the patient is prone, that would strengthen my argument for intervening surgically.
Sure. Do you think there might be any role for elastography in these patients of the spinal cord, or do you know if that's been done?
I don't know whether it's been done. Yeah.
No, just to go back to Dr. Bergstein and your comment, I think the key to this, you know, selecting those more challenging patients is actually going to be the clinical history, not so much the imaging. So if you have a patient with, you know, clear bilateral leg, especially in the pediatric population, it's rare to have leg pain, a child complaining of back pain or leg pain, any bladder disturbance. To me, you almost need a explanation. I mean, it's one thing to say as a surgeon, you know, I don't think this is it, go, and you send them off to the abyss of sort of, you know, seeing a whole bunch of other people. But if you have that triad or the more of those symptoms that you have, I think that pushes you over to do, especially an operation that has, I'd say, minimal risk, right? If done properly, you really shouldn't get a tethered cord. You shouldn't get, you know, arachnoiditis and all that. So, I think, you know, it becomes more challenging when all the symptoms are subjective, right? So pain, lower, you know, we do have a spina bifida clinic where we send them for pre-surgical bladder evaluation. And that way you get some objective data, say there are some signs of neurogenic bladder or their bladder capacity's changed or some, and it helps us. So we don't just rely on a subjective report. But I will also say, you know, it's definitely a selection bias, right? If we say we're only going to treat the ones that are clear cut, and yes, they do well, hence no one else does well, that's not really a comparison. So hence the need for this trial that's happening, because it is controversial. It is, I've tended to give those patients a benefit of the doubt. We recently did a patient who was sort of was toe walking and was basically told your kid's just like this. The kid was in the normal position, had some fatty infiltration. We did the surgery, and 2 weeks post-op, she's walking better. So we have those rare cases. That shouldn't be the norm. That shouldn't be the, you know, reason to sort of offer everyone surgery. But you got to take the time. I think more important than just staring at the imaging here is getting a good history and physical exam.
Good point. Yeah. By the way, I did pass out some selected references for people who want to read about this. A lot been written about this, but some of the papers are not cited very often, like the ones from O'Connor and Sullivan. Okay, thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed this presentation. The material provided in this program is for informational purposes and is not intended for use as a diagnosis or treatment of a health problem or as a substitute for consulting a licensed medical professional. Fill out your evaluation, please, of this video to obtain CME credit. And this recorded session is available free on snidigital.org. Send your comments, questions, or requests for CME to ausman@snidigital.org. This program is from the UCLA Department of Neurosurgery and also two other publications, Surgical Neurology International, a 2D internet journal, whose editor-in-chief is Nancy Epstein, and the web address is sni.global, and SNI Digital, Innovations in Learning, a 3D video journal, interactive with discussion, and its web address is snidigital.org. Both are free on the internet to everyone. Surgical Neurology International is the journal is read in 239 countries and territories. It's the third largest neurosurgery journal in the world in readership. And SNI Digital Innovations in Learning has just been launched about 4 months ago and is now in almost 100 countries. It's the first video journal of neurosurgery. The Medical News Network is a network also owned by the foundation, and it brings truthful medical and science news to the people in the world. Thank you.